Paris Perspective.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Paris Perspective with me, David Coffey. Despite doomsayers calling the upcoming EU elections a time of reckoning for the European project with the rise of the far right across the bloc, it is unlikely the centrist conservative majority in Parliament will be knocked off pole position. But the main battle for EU seats in June will nevertheless be fought between centrists and populists. However, despite waning turnout for direct European elections since their inception in 1979, the 2019 polls broke the 50% turnout threshold for the first time in 20 years. And in a post-COVID, economically rattled union with two wars on its doorstep, indicators point to a significant rise in interest in the upcoming elections this summer. The myriad polls and statistics are hard to digest and should be approached with measured caution. But the latest survey carried out by the European Parliament indicates that a record turnout of 68% could be expected. On Paris Perspective today, I'm joined by Christine Verger, Vice President of the Jacques Delors Institute here in Paris. Christine, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
You're welcome.
Now, if one is to believe the statistics, it would appear that Europeans are more interested in the European Union than ever. Now, does that, in your opinion, mean that the European Union is regarded as a positive force in 2024?
Well, as you said before, in 2019, there was a rise in the global participation in the European elections. And according to the studies which we could read since then, it seems that the rise of the participation was due mainly to the young people all over Europe in most countries, and the young people at the time were mainly interested in the protection of environment and the climate change. And they thought, and they still think, that the European level is the right level to address such important international matters. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So now, after 5 years, the issue of the protection of environment, the Green Deal, etc., has become not only an issue viewed as a positive contribution of the European Union, but by many sectors of the population, we can see it with the agriculture protests at the moment, it's seen as a problem and not anymore as a solution. So how will the young people will react in 2024 to this new challenge? This is very difficult to say now. But there are other issues which may justify the rise of the participation and also some positive views on the European Union. It's linked to the state of the world and the wars in Ukraine, in the Middle East. And this situation, those new challenges may lead for many people in the European Union to a sort of feeling of protection by the European Union, a sort of security for them against those main challenges.
Indeed, you have touched on something there that, I mean, 5 years ago, the youth vote mobilized itself very much towards a greener European Union. You say that there are now, of course, troubles within the Union with, you know, when it comes to farmers and, of course, the geopolitical forces that are at play. So there is a demographic shift there that is bringing renewed interest to the project. But, I mean, when one goes on the metros here in Paris, there is a sizable marketing drive targeting young voters to take an interest in the workings of the European Union as a force for good. But in your opinion, could that also backfire? You're talking about security there. That's also a big theme that the far right have been pushing forward. Could this backfire? Could this mobilization of a youth vote backfire with Eurosceptic populist parties actually garnering that youth vote?
Well, you know, the main problem of the European elections is the fact that it is 27 national elections. It's not really a European elections. There were some attempts in the past to make it more European, for instance, the creation of transnational lists or the idea, you know, of the political families, the European political families appointing candidates for the presidency of the Commission who may campaign at the pan-European level, you know, to defend their ideas. Mm. But this does not work so well because national governments and national parliaments are not so inclined to accept such European solutions for the campaigns. They are still very attached to the national environment to conduct the campaigns. So in each country, the situation is different. I mean, in France, you have the Rassemblement National, but already in 2019, the Rassemblement National made a very good score. They have 23 members in the European Parliament. They may have a few more, but this will not have an influence on the result of the European elections. Let's not forget the European Parliament is composed of 705 members. Mm-hmm. From June on, it will be 720 members linked to the evolution of demography in certain member states. So even if the far right, which is, by the way, divided in two main groups in the European Parliament, gets more members in the European Parliament for all the reasons we know, immigration, contestation of the Green Deal, identity issues, this will not, to my opinion, completely change the way the European Parliament from a political point of view is functioning for the moment.
Now, I was going to delve into the whole functioning and how the whole actual exercise works, but I think we'd need an entire program dedicated to that in itself to be compounded into the short period that we have with our conversation today. But when looking at the workings of the institutions in Europe, you touched on something there that is interesting, and that is, of course, the grouping of the parties in the European Parliament. And how are they actually determined? If you can give a quick synopsis, especially when it comes to, let's just say, the centrists, who are the EPP, but also how does it work for new or unrepresented parties who don't have any natural affiliation?
Yeah, well, okay, that's a minority. For the moment, you have what we call, I don't know if there is a translation in English, the non-inscrits,
unaligned,
unaligned members. Well, for the moment, there are some, I don't remember exactly the figure, some 40 or 50, which is something, but not so important, and I don't think there will be more in the future. In the European Parliament, you have two main, let's say, right-wing groups, which are very different, by the way. And I think there is a confusion very often between what is concerning what is called populist and radical parties. They are very different. And that's why they have some difficulties, because they don't share the same opinions on many issues. For instance, the relation to Russia and the position towards the war in Ukraine. You have a group which is called ID, Identity and Democracy, which is composed mainly of two main parties, the French Rassemblement National and the German AfD. And the German AfD, as you know, for the moment is rising in Germany. And you have representatives of small parties. And if you take this example of this political group, the AfD in Germany, their representative, has declared last weekend that there could be a referendum on Germany leaving the European Union, what they call the Dexit. Mm-hmm. It's not the Frexit, it's not the Brexit, it's the Dexit. Mm-hmm. The Rassemblement National in France is not at all in favor of leaving the European Union. It may have been a position 20 years ago. So how are those two parties within the same group going to cooperate in the future? And on the other hand, you have another political group which is considered as a populist or, let's say, right-wing group, but not exactly the same as the first one, which is the ECR, European Conservatives and Reformists. This group was led by the British Conservatives before the Brexit. The British left, so now the main group there is the peace, the Polish peace. And you know very well that this party lost the elections in Poland.
Indeed, yes, last recently, September.
Autumn. So mm-hmm. we don't know how they are going to evolve. And for sure, there is such a division between the PiS, which is in this group, and the party of Mr. Tusk, which won the elections in the autumn and which is in the EPP. So you can't imagine any cooperation between this group, ECR, and the EPP group, which is the group of the center-right. So the far-right, the populist, the radical parties, in my view, have no chance in the future to build a majority by themselves, because in the European Parliament, everything is based on alliances,
indeed,
compromises. There is not one majority and one opposition. There are several political groups which have to cooperate between themselves to build majorities. And even if those two groups, ID and ECR, are more powerful after the elections in June, mainly because of the rise of the AfD and the rise of the party of Mrs. Meloni in Italy, first of all, they don't share the same views between themselves. And secondly, they will not be powerful enough to build a right-wing radical alternative.
So
that's not a reason why not to be worried mm-hmm. about the rise of those groups, for sure.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, that one should not take this as a given that there will be a massive surge in the far right within the European elections, because there is no consensus and there is no history of consensus within them, the more extreme-leaning parties across the European project. But indeed, the EU and the status quo and the people at the top, at the EPP, for example, they can't rest on their laurels. I mean, are we sure that the youth are very happy to vote for the centrist, technocratic, pragmatic view, and that will actually prevail? I mean, this is yet to be seen. We're looking too much into the crystal ball. But there is a question that I do want to put to you, is about how do you feel that the mainstream parties are actually doing themselves to counter the populist campaigns? I mean, let's call a spade a spade. The populists across the board, no matter what their national affiliations or their national issues are, they still use the same tactics of fear, anger, economic instability, immigration as their driving forces. And they all use powerful emotions and very mm-hmm. astutely amplify these emotions through social media. So do you think that the old technocrats in Brussels and in Strasbourg are able to take on this new mobilization of emotions?
No, first of all, they are not old technocrats.
Touché.
At least this is my view. I mean, first of all, the members of the European Parliament are people who are elected by the citizens. So you may say technocrats if you think of the civil servants, but I mean the commissioners, the president of the commissioner and the commissioners are, first of all politicians who've been important persons in their national countries, and they are all elected now by the European Parliament. The European Council is composed of prime ministers of the different countries, so you can't say the people in Brussels are old technocrats. You refer probably to the EPP family.
I do. or
maybe the Social Democrats. Okay. But, I mean, it's interesting to see that in many countries, the parties of the EPP remain rather powerful parties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you take in Germany, even if they are for the moment in the opposition, the CDU, it remains a powerful political party. If you take in Spain, the Popular Party, which is at the moment in the opposition, it's a powerful party. So in France, of course, the two main traditional parties have more or less disappeared Yeah. But this is France. This is not the case in all over Europe. You see what I mean?
On the subject of, let's just say, people calling this election a referendum on the European Union, a lot of people here in France, especially the French media, are framing the 2024 elections as a precursor for the 2027 presidential elections, which will most likely see President Macron's successor face off Marine Le Pen in the race for the Élysée Palace. Now, how important are these EU elections for the evolving landscape of French national politics? It looks like Macron's Renaissance Party is shifting right of centre to fight off the far right, and the National Rally has a 28-year-old president, Jordan Bardella. Is the country preparing for, I don't know, a battle of the pretty boys now with the announcement of one of the youngest prime ministers, if not the youngest prime minister ever to take the seat here in France?
Yeah, of course, the European elections, as I said before, are important in view of the national context. But this is not new. It has always been like this. I remember, for instance, I give you an example. In 1994, European elections, June 1994, Mr. Rocard, the head of the Socialist Party, was the main candidate for the Socialist Party at the European elections. The Socialist Party in June 1994 made a very bad score at the European election. Mr. Rocard made a very bad score. Following those European elections in 1994, Mr. Rocard was not anymore the candidate of the Socialist Party because he had lost the European elections. So you see what I mean? So it's not new that the European elections may have an impact on the national context. As I said, it's 27 national elections. So, of course, in June 2024, according to the results, it's a proportional election, there will be lessons to be drawn in view of the next elections. Of course, if the score of the list of Mr. Macron is very low, it will be difficult for him until 2027, for sure.
It'll be a wake-up call.
If Mr. Bardella makes a very much higher score than in 2019, of course, it will be a sign in view of 2027. The political landscape will not change fundamentally. But the European elections will give signs to the national context. And what is new compared to 1994 is that, as you said before, the European issues will certainly play a certain role in the elections. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bardella tries, and this is in a way a response to your last question, Mr. Bardella tries to make it a 100% national election. And the other parties, in particular Renaissance, and even the Socialist Party with Mr. Glucksmann, will try to make it as European as possible in order to disconnect it a little bit from the national context and to try and show the positive aspects of the European Union for the ordinary citizens.
Okay, Christine, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Christine Verger, the Vice President of the Institut Jacques Delors here in Paris. Thank you for joining me on Paris Perspective today.
You're welcome. Thank you to you.